make sure that there we go. Now we're in business. Okay. Good morning. It is 10 a.m. October 14th, 2009. This is the North Dakota Public Service Commission meeting at our regularly scheduled biweekly meeting on the 12th floor of the State Capitol in the Public Service Commission hearing room. This is Kevin Kramer along with Tony Clark and Brian Kalk for today's meeting. I would just say up front before asking for comments of welcome and greetings from my colleagues that today is not only our regularly scheduled meeting, but this is the 99th birthday of Coach John Wooden. And so I want to wish the coach a happy birthday down in California. And I know he's not listening in. But I
sure,
sent
it's
8
a.m. there. I mean, if it was 10, he probably...
He might be at 10, yeah. At any rate, so with that, colleagues.
Good morning. Welcome.
I would say the same thing and remind folks that the Vikings are still undefeated.
But the Bison do have a win. One. All right. With that, KC1. I move the commission accept the federal office of... Oh, I'm sorry.
I'll move the items on consent.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
There wasn't a lot on it, but there's some. KC1, I move the commission accept the Federal Office of Surface Mining's 2009 evaluation report for the abandoned mine land program.
Second.
Recently received OSM's oversight report, and it was glowing as always. It was emailed, of course, to the commissioners. No issues were raised or concerns with the program, and the report states clearly, once again, that the AML division and the Reclamation Division administer an excellent AML program in full compliance with our approved plan. So congratulations to Jim, to Bill, and the entire staff once again on being recognized by OSM for doing a great job.
All in favor?
Aye. Aye.
KC2, I move the commission approve bond release number 3 for surface coal mining permit number ROJK8701. Held by Royal Oak Enterprises, Inc., to release all remaining reclamation liabilities on 116.17 acres located in the northeast quarter of Section 3, T-140 North, R-96 West in Stark County. The amount of the bond release is $223,445, and it will become effective November 16, 2009, unless a formal hearing is requested.
Second.
This 113 acres is, or this acreage is largely hayland. 113 acres of it is hayland. There was another little over 3 acres used for a developed water resource and a drainage way. Basically, it was a sedimentation pond, is my understanding, that is continued now to operate as a, I think, for a stock pond and for benefit wildlife. It's good, clean water. Probably the most interesting thing about this bond release, it is the final bond release. It now closes the final chapter on the Royal Oak briquetting plant facilities and mine that about 400-acre mine out there that provided coal to that briquetting plant, along with other mines, I guess, that delivered some coal. The plant began operation in the late 1920s, and this is the final bond release and the final acreage of the mine that's associated with it. So always kind of interesting bit of history there out at Royal Oak.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
KC3. I move the commission close out contract number AM560-08 with B&C Concrete Pumping, Inc. for completion of work at the Williams County Road 9 Phase 3 Abandoned Mine Land Reclamation Project.
Second.
This has been a rather long project. Began with our awarding of the contract in April of 2008. Drilling and grouting were conducted along County Road 9, some township roads, and several residences near Grand View Subdivision. It occurred between June 6th and October 10th of 08. And then there was an extension needed in order to repair a lifting feature caused by grouting on County Road 9. So some repair work in conjunction with the Williams County Highway Department was completed in August of this year. There were also several change orders during the project to increase the units of casing and grout injection. At any rate, it's finally complete, and we want to close out the contract.
All in favor?
Aye.
KC4. I move the commission deem the application complete and issue a notice of filing and a notice of hearing in the application of Hawthorne Oil Transportation, North Dakota, Inc.'s application for a certificate of corridor compatibility and a route permit authorizing the construction of an 8-inch crude oil pipeline in Montreal County, North Dakota, case number PU09153.
Second.
This is a, and I do have some information for those of you. I can hand out a map, actually, for the media if you want one a little bit later. But this is a rather short line, obviously, from my storage facility to another storage facility that will take crude oil. Hawthorne, of course, is a subsidiary of EOG. It'll take the crude oil to the storage facility, as I understand it, that is right next to the newly constructed or being constructed rail facility that EOG has built near Stanley. And I've been up there to see it. It's quite a fascinating way to move oil. That's all I can say. This oil, interestingly, will be going, I believe, more toward Oklahoma. So one thing about rail, you have a few more options when you're railing than when you're sending down a pipe to a single destination. But at any rate, this will help facilitate the moving of some more of the oil out of the Bakken into markets down the road. It is estimated at a cost of $2.5 million. As I recall from the letter of intent, this has been some time ago now, I think it was earlier this spring. It was originally, I think, a 12-inch pipeline, if I remember. But at any rate, 6 miles of 8-inch will do for this.
All in favor?
Aye.
KC5. I move the commission award a contract to Basaraba Excavating and Dirtworks LLC in the amount of $91,275 for the 2009 maintenance sinkhole filling AML project that involves filling sinkholes at several abandoned underground coal mine sites in western North Dakota.
Second.
This is simply awarding the contract that we noticed an intent to award previously. As a low bid came in at $91,275, there were five bids that were received in response to the solicitation, this one, of course, being the lowest one. Primary purpose of the project is to fill underground coal mine sinkholes near Noonan, Dickinson, Wilton, and Beulah Zapp. There is, however, a contingency item for the successful bidder to fill other dangerous sinkholes that are reported at other sites up to the ending date of the contract, which will be June 30th of next year.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. And to KC6, I move the commission acknowledge the letter of intent, shorten the one-year waiting period between filing a letter of intent and a citing application to 1 day, and assess a filing fee of $15,000 due upon the filing of an application in case number PU09663, Hawthorne Oil Transportation, Inc.'s proposed 4.5-inch condensate pipeline in Montreal County, North Dakota.
Second.
This is an 11-mile, 4.5-inch condensate pipeline to transport condensate from an existing Stanley gas plant, which is about 7 miles east of Stanley, to an independently owned storage facility located about 2 miles northeast of Stanley. It'll provide an alternate to current truck transportation and provides additional markets to producers in the area. Condensate is a mixture of hydrocarbon liquids that condense out of raw natural gas. If the gas temperature is sufficiently reduced, its estimated investment cost is about $3 million. Plans are to begin construction on or before February 1 of next year. It lasts about 3 months with completion on or before May 1st of next year. We learned a little bit about condensate when we had the jurisdictional question raised a year or so ago. Commissioner Kalk, you weren't able to be part of all of that, but part of the processing, of course, taking some of those liquid condensates out, but not all of them, as we recall, several are remaining in the gas going down to markets in the industrial Midwest.
All in favor?
Aye.
And that ends items in my portfolio, finally. Commissioner Clark.
Item TC1, I move the commission issue an order in case number GE09662 granting the request of Hankinson Renewable Energy, LLC, to operate a 1,141,000 bushel grain warehouse at Hankinson, North Dakota, effective October 2nd, 2009.
Second.
This is the facility formerly known as Verisun. It is being licensed as Hankinson Renewable Energy, LLC. They actually filed this and received temporary authorization on October 2nd so they could begin receiving grain and processing it.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. TC2, I move the commission issue a notice of hearing in BNSF Railway Company's application for review of private railroad crossings, case number RR09651.
Second.
This is the first one of these that we've had, I believe, under the new law that was passed not too long ago. It's North Dakota Century Code Section 491121. Basically, it allows the commission to receive a petition from the railroad to identify crossings where warning devices may, private crossings where sound devices don't need to be sounded off, the horns don't need to be blown at certain crossings. And in this case, BNSF is petitioning for 7 specific crossings where they would like to no longer sound the warning devices roughly, and there are specific crossing numbers associated with each of these, but they're associated with crossings near Crary, Erie, Page, Heimdall, Williston, Mandan, and Hebron. We're setting a public hearing date for here in the commission hearing room, December 1st, 2009 at 10 a.m. I know one of the things that we'll probably be talking about between now and then is trying to get the word out to the public. The reason that we, of course, hold these is we want to get feedback. The BNSF in their application did send photographs of the crossings that are in question, but we really need to hear from the public in this particular case because we don't know exactly how much each of those are used. And obviously, if there are private landowners who still wish them to be sounded, that would be something the commission would want to take into consideration.
Just to echo on a little bit of what Commissioner Clark said, when I first got into this, it's interesting because it seems like there's a trend. Last night in the news, they talk about even in Bismarck, they want to have the quiet rail, and you know, living in Fargo, working in NDSU, there was the concerns about that. And it is, you know, I'm very interested how this is going to shape out. We've got to get the right people there because this is pure safety. You know, if these are in the middle of nowhere blowing the horn, what's the concern going to be? But yet all of us, they brought them to us to make some decisions, and in the process we follow here, I think we'll follow around the state. So this is going to be interesting.
All in favor?
Aye. TC3, I move the commission acknowledge the letter of intent shortened the 1-year waiting period between filing a letter of intent and a siting application to 3 weeks and assess a filing fee of $100,000 due upon the filing of an application in case number PU09668, Next Era Resources, LLC's proposed Baldwin Wind Energy Center in Burley County, North Dakota.
Second.
It's a letter of intent that we received from Next Era Energy that gives us a heads up on the commission that they're going to be filing an actual application fairly soon. They indicate that they would like to have the application filed on November 1st of this year, so in just a few weeks, which is why we're shortening the waiting period to that 3-week time frame. The proposed project is to take up about 21 square miles of private land, leased private land. It's going to be fairly close to Bismarck, proposed to be fairly close to Bismarck, about 15 or 20 miles north. Geographically, roughly speaking, where we're talking about is just to the east of U.S. 83, near the town of Baldwin, and just to the south of North Dakota Highway 36. The project is proposed to interconnect with Western Area Power Administration's high-voltage lines and take power to WAPA markets. The project itself is proposed 99 megawatt project, and the approximate construction cost estimated to be about $200 million. As far as construction timetable, they're looking at if all goes as Next Era hope it goes, to begin construction on June 10th of next year, completing it by December 31st of next year.
All in favor?
Aye.
TC4, I move the commission acknowledge the letter of intent shorten the 1-year waiting period between filing a letter of intent and citing an application to 3 weeks and assess a filing fee of $5,000 due upon the filing of an application in case number PU09674, Otter Tail Power Company's proposed reroute of a 0.53-mile segment of its Hankinson to Ellendale 230 kV transmission line in Sargent County, North Dakota.
Second.
This particular transmission line is one that's important for reliability purposes in the southeast part of the state. It's owned by Otter Tail Corp. And the proposed reroute is very small. It appears to be contained really on just one landowner's piece of land. It's about a half-mile long reroute. It's basically to get it out of a small lake where there are some existing structures. So this starts the process, but I know that Otter Tail is interested in having that taken care of so that it decreases the chance of that line going out in the spring when ice starts to thaw and so on and so forth.
All in favor?
Aye.
That ends the items in my portfolio.
Okay. There's nothing in Commissioner Culk's portfolio today. A couple of announcements. We do have a formal hearing coming up October 27th, Basin Electric's 230 kV transmission line, the Williams and Montreal County siting app. That will be in the City Commission hearing room in Williston at 10:30. My announcement sheet says p.m., but I'm quite confident that's not right. 10:30 a.m., Tuesday, October 27th. Anyway, and then we do have a periodic information exchange meeting with the Montana Dakota Utilities this afternoon at 2:30. And I should also announce, I should have mentioned during my explanation of KC4, which is the filing a notice of hearing in the Hawthorne Oil Pipeline, that we have that also on the agenda for scheduling because we haven't set the date and time. So we'll have that after our scheduling meeting during the scheduling portion of the administrative meeting. With that, any other announcements?
Just one notice. I'd like to recognize Laura McCartan. She's the new regional VP for NSPXL. She's here today, and we're visiting with her throughout the day.
Any questions?
And Dave Cedarquist, of course.
I was looking at page one.
Yes.
Has Wednesday always been misspelled, or am I?
Congratulations, he finally noticed. We have been wondering how long.
I'm waiting for you, Dale.
It would go before someone would notice that.
We've got October
14th. A couple things on the consent agenda. The turbine location transfer, CTC1. How many turbines is that involved, you know?
It's just one, yeah, and it was a fairly minor move. Try to find them. If you're interested in the number of feet, I don't have it there. Oh, wait, I do. It was related to the cultural resource site that they were trying to avoid. 151 feet.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. BK1 on the consent agenda, the application for trade secret protection. Is there any way to elaborate on just what it is, the information they are seeking to be protected?
In a general sense, it was the they gave us a very detailed diagram of how exactly they moved their data around, and they wanted that information held in their own protection.
Okay.
So they have a upcoming PI meeting where we're going to go into more detail on the what exactly the investigation that they came through, what they're going to incorporate in the timeline, but this is one of the first steps to make sure that we can continue getting the information to us and the public.
Okay. And Royal Oak Enterprises, do you know how large that mine was?
It was originally, Dale, about 400 acres, so it wasn't a huge mine. Now, there were other mines in the area that also delivered coal to the briquetting plant, but the original mine was about 400.
Okay. And just so that I'm clear, this is the last of the reclaimed land.
This is it. This is the final chapter of a mine and a plant that began in the late 20s, 1920s.
Do you know when it quit supplying coal?
I want to say early 90s. 90. Do I know that for sure?
1990.
I don't remember when the plant shut down. Does anyone remember?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, that makes sense. The I want to make sure I have my data correct on the oil pipeline. How long is that? It's 6 miles long and 8-inch?
It is.
Okay. And it goes from, let's see, one location near Stanley to another.
Yeah.
I'm trying to remember here. Can you tell me what you described earlier in terms of
its sure. Basically, what it does is it transports oil from an existing storage facility to another storage facility. The new storage facility is right next to the new rail transport facility, so it'll help accommodate the transporting of this oil on the new EOG rail cars, I guess, rail loading facility, which will ultimately facilitate the transporting of the oil to different markets.
So when you talked about a fascinating way to move oil, you were talking about rail transportation of oil.
Well, the pipeline allows it to get to the, obviously, the most efficient way to get to the rail facility. Rail is not the most efficient or perhaps fastest way to transport oil, but it does, at this point in time when we have the constraints that we have, it does provide a new outlet. Plus, Dale, one of the things that I guess I find more somewhat fascinating about rail, whether it's permanent or whether it's temporary, and I think for now we think it might be temporary, but it does provide multiple market opportunities, whereas a pipeline, you know, the Enbridge line, as we know, takes oil directly from western North Dakota into Minnesota to Clearbrook. Trains have a few more options, which I find interesting. I don't know that they're looking at a lot of options. I think the main destination is Oklahoma, but nonetheless, the train does provide that. And when you consider that our producers are being paid a discounted price as a result of not having multiple markets, perhaps some of that discount can be mitigated. And that's strictly my speculation, but I do find it at least interesting.
Dale, if I could, too, throw out there that one of the safety aspects of this pipeline is it'll greatly reduce the truck traffic in and around Stanley. I mean, Highway 2, there's been some significant accidents up there there's a lot of big trucks moving around. So when these pipeline gets built, the truck traffic in Stanley will be reduced. Highway 2 safety is increased. So that's a big component to these pipelines as well.
Do you know where the beginning and the end of this pipeline is going to be in relationship to Stanley?
I do, actually, and I even have a map for you, but the beginning point is just sort of the southeast of Stanley. It then sort of follows an existing right-of-way route and ends up actually northeast of Stanley. So as the crow flies, it's not very far at all, but the route sort of follows some existing right-of-ways and goes east and north and then back west a little bit before going north up to the new facility.
Do they cross Highway 2, right?
Mm-hmm. They do.
The reason I asked the earlier question was you mentioned a fascinating way to move oil, and I didn't know.
I was referring to the train.
I thought, you know, you're talking about a spaceship or what.
Well, that would be fascinating, yeah.
The condensate pipeline, mm-hmm. That's 11 miles, 4.5 inches.
It is.
7 miles east of Stanley to 2 miles northeast.
Yes.
You mentioned an independent storage facility. Do you know who owns that?
I do not know who owns the facility. Somebody in the room may, but I don't know right off the top of my head.
And the purpose of the pipeline is to store this condensate for what reason?
Well, and I don't know what all condensate is necessarily in that will be removed, what impurities, I guess, or hydrocarbons will be removed. I do recall that several will remain because that was part of the discussion and the debate around whether we had jurisdiction over this facility a year or so ago. But they are liquid impurities like, I want to say butane, but I don't know that butane is one of them. I actually have a list of some impurities that it could be, or some of the hydrocarbons that it could be, but they're liquid hydrocarbons that clearly, in the company's mind, have a market. I don't know what those markets necessarily are, but they're most likely liquid fuels of some sort.
But they're storing this because they think it has value and they want to sell it.
That's my understanding. Yes.
Okay. the Hankinson Renewable Energy, that's the, I presume this is because of the acquisition by Murphy Oil of the plant.
That's correct. They needed to, well, the old license obviously had been pulled in the bankruptcy, but yeah, this allows them to get back in business.
Are they making ethanol again or on the verge of doing so? Do you know?
Well, all I know is from what I read in the newspapers, and it's our understanding that they are, again, in the business of procuring grain and processing the grain into ethanol. At what stage they are of getting ramped up, I don't know specifically.
And when did this take effect?
It took effect October 2nd with temporary authorization, and we're recognizing it today.
But just so that I'm clear, they've been able to buy grain for almost 2 weeks now.
Correct. Yeah, the paperwork really came in right after our last commission meeting.
I was at a meeting a couple of days ago, Dale, and it's my understanding that it is, in fact, operating and producing ethanol.
Okay. The BNSF Railway private railroad crossings.
Mm-hmm.
Now, did I want to make sure I'm clear on this. Did the railroad make this request?
The railroad is petitioning the commission for these seven crossings, yes.
I'm kind of baffled by that because why would the railroad care whether they blow the horn?
You know, I'm sure that's one of the questions that we will ask as we get into it. It may be at the request of landowners who have talked to them about it. It may be just various crossings that they know about that they believe to be very infrequently used. And if used at all, perhaps only by private residences. So it's one of the questions we'll ask at the hearing.
Well, I guess, yeah, I guess I'm just puzzled as to why they would care when they blow their horn.
Well, it may, I don't know either. I'm the same as you, Dale. I was a little bit intrigued by the fact that it was the railroad petitioning when you hear so much news about neighbors petitioning for similar treatment. But, you know, I'm only speculating, but perhaps the railroad is responding to, you know, to neighbors. Who knows? But
yeah, and I suspect we'll learn a lot about the law and how the, you know, federal rail laws apply to this as opposed to state ones as we get into it. Remember, this is the first time we've ever heard a case like this. So, you know, why coming to the state in this particular matter with these particular crossings will be interesting to
Could
learn
you just
about.
Talk about what you hope to, how you're going to go about this? The process you're going to do and
at the hearing?
What you hope to accomplish, yes.
Sure. Well, we had to pick a hearing site. It appeared that Bismarck was as centrally located as anywhere else. These are crossings that are located throughout the state. And what we hope to gather is as much affected public input as we can. And it would appear from the information that BNSF is submitted so far that these tend to be fairly rural. They're private crossings. They apparently tend to be ones that are not heavily traveled, but nonetheless, whenever you're talking about removing something that is currently being done that is a public safety protection, which is blowing these horns at crossings, the commission wants to be very careful and make sure that at the very least, the most affected parties know that we've got this type of proceeding before the commission and that they have the ability to be heard.
Are you expecting many more of these requests?
I don't know. I didn't have an expectation that we'd necessarily receive this one, but I suppose the fact that someone took the time to introduce a bill, it made it through both chambers of the legislature, indicates that there was some need that someone had out there that they wanted this in state law. So I suspect we may have some others, perhaps if not from BNSF, perhaps from other railways.
My recollection might be faulty, but isn't this, frankly, a cup that you did not want to drink from?
Well, that was my point about the I'm very reluctant just before hearing the point of we've got safety mechanisms that have been in place for years and we start pulling away safety. I don't know. I'm looking forward to the hearing, Dale.
I mean, the commission didn't take a position on the bill. But
oh, come on. You didn't want the bill to
do a thing. We had bigger fish to fry.
Because I was, you know, one of the reasons I was curious about whether it was a railroad asking is I'm thinking, well, okay, somebody gets smacked at the Quarry Crossing, they come and say, well, you know, you want.
It could be a liability issue, you know, that these are private crossings and the railroad currently has an obligation to blow the horn. Or it could be an issue of folks have been listening to horns blaring outside their windows for years at private crossings and they really don't want them to do that anymore. I don't know. I mean, that's why we have hearings and that's why we hope to hear from as many parties as are affected.
And you haven't gotten any requests from landowners themselves, have you?
Yeah. No.
I don't think it's unreasonable that I personally, I plan on trying to go out and look at some of these crossings myself before the hearing just to get a visual of what they look like, because the pictures, when we first got the pictures, it's hard to really see what we're talking about here. So this will be, you know, very interesting, and I think there's going to be a pretty good record of case record developed before we come to any decision on this one.
Is it necessarily more logical to not blow the horn at a rural crossing as it is at an urban one?
Well, in this case, these are all, it appears, private crossings, so that may be a little different than rural-urban. Now, the fact is they happen to be in rural areas and private crossings, so that's a little bit of a second issue. But I think your point is well taken, that, you know, perhaps it is as much needed as in rural areas, generally speaking, on public roads.
You know, if any of
as
these...
As in urban areas, just because... You may be more aware of looking around for those things in an urban area. There's more traffic, but you might be looking for cross traffic in an urban area, whereas in a rural area, you might just be flying along and...
Out pheasant hunting
and paying more attention to roosters than trains.
Or you get in the routine of your, you know, your daily route, and it's altered suddenly by a locomotive. But, the fact of the matter is that while we remain open-minded... Clearly, public safety is our top priority.
I drive this way every day, and everyone knows it. You know, that kind
yeah,
of
so why is this train in my way? Yeah.
I mean, do you know if any of these crossings are in what you would call a built-up area, an urban area?
It, from the pictures that were submitted, it didn't appear that way, but we'll find out.
The Baldwin Wind Energy Center, how yes. close is that to the existing wind farm out there?
It is, yeah. It's fairly close. It's fairly close. On the map that we have, it's not indicated exactly. I think that, gosh, will this one be closer or not?
Closer to
Bismarck.
Yes, I believe so.
I think it is closer to Bismarck, but it's in a very similar area. I mean, the Wilton Wind Farm is Wilton. This is the Baldwin Wind Farm, which isn't far from Wilton, although it's on the south side of it, but it's very close to Wilton as well.
But the new development is to the south of Wilton.
It's to the south of 36, okay. And it's to the south of Wilton, okay. And it's to the east of 83.
So the view out the 12th floor window hearing room will, you know, be altered slightly.
I'm looking at this letter about Google Voice. What is this about?
I put that on the admin agenda. You know, we're not really going to talk about it now, I guess. We could a little bit. But
sure you can.
I guess the background of it is that Congressman John Klein, he's a retired Marine. I know the congressman. And a couple weeks ago, his staff members sent me a copy of this letter. And so I looked through it, and it looked to me to be very unique, you know, laying how we've got 20 congressmen, you know, Republicans and Democrats from neighboring states, Minnesota, South Dakota, would like the FCC to weigh in on this case. And so I thought it'd be good for us to talk about it in our admin agenda, and I assume that the FCC will open up some kind of docket, and at that time it might be appropriate for the commission to, I think it would be appropriate for us to weigh in and what we think this should fall out. But it's really the beginning stages of, you know, what are the rules for making phone calls over the Internet. And I guess my thought would be to determine the impact to North Dakota telecoms, North Dakota ratepayers. We want to increase our services in the state. We want to make sure that we're fair to all our customers.
What's that issue is an allegation that Google Voice has been blocking phone calls into rural exchanges in an attempt to avoid paying the access fees. Google Voice advertises their service for free. And so this is, we'll find out, but it seems to me anyway to be a, you know, an economic move on their part to be able to advertise and market free telephony services in an industry that is, you know, that has real clear both federal and state rules. The irony to me in all of this and in Google's actions is that Google is the biggest proponent. And when I say biggest, I mean both the loudest and probably the largest entity who's a proponent of network neutrality, where they are they're pushing the FCC chairman to and the FCC to have greater regulation to provide rules that don't allow discrimination on the internet by the providers. At the same time, the big user of the internet, that being Google, is engaged in discrimination. So the irony is rich, as far as I'm concerned, in Google's position in all of this.
Yeah, just well, Kevin's point, to go back to, I guess my first thought was that, you know, we're not sure that they're blocking calls in North Dakota, but it would seem reasonable if they are in Minnesota and South Dakota. And we want to increase services in all of North Dakota. I think there's a role for Google. But as Kevin has pointed out clearly, that there's no guidelines right now, and the FCC needs to weigh in. Are they a regulated carrier or are they not? And then how will that affect what we do in North Dakota?
I mean,
from a state perspective, it's almost certain that this is an interstate issue, though. I mean, it's
right.
And clearly within the federal jurisdiction,
sure,
that, you know, state intrastate access won't apply. The FCC, and it was upheld by the Eighth Circuit a number of years ago, classified what they call nomadic VoIP providers, nomadic voice over internet providers, which Google Voice clearly is, as a inherently interstate service. So the most that we would be able to move the needle on it from a state commission perspective is if the FCC opens a proceeding, providing comments as part of that proceeding.
I guess the question I was getting to is, even if it was blocking numbers in North Dakota, what could you all do about it?
We can't.
Yeah, we can't. Except exactly. Advocate for North Dakotans with the FCC.
Similar to cap and trade, we've got federal decisions being made that we weigh in on one way or the other, that we look at this and we provide potential recommendations to the FCC as well as our delegation. It's noted that, you know, Congressman Pomeroy didn't sign off on this one way or the other, so I'd be interested why that took place.
Do you know if he has subsequent to this date?
Yeah, I don't know that he has subsequent to that. Yeah, they do. Clearly they do. Yeah, there's always a blank sheet. I oftentimes have taken them and signed my name to them. But the interesting thing, though, I think it's an interesting debate, because how the FCC deals with the new technologies of the web and the sort of the old technologies of telephony is going to be a big issue. And I think they do have to, in my mind, I think they have to bifurcate some of those issues. They're in, at least until some such time as there's complete deregulation of telephone. But what I hate to see is that I'm a real advocate for against network neutrality. I should probably advocate is the wrong word, but I don't support network neutrality, because I think to this point the internet has provided tremendous opportunity for innovation and investment, both private and public investment, with very few problems, and whatever antitrust problems there have been dealt with very easily by the Department of Justice and FTC. But telephony is different. So how you're able to layer that, or if the FCC can layer that and treat the telephony side of the internet different than the data side and all of those things, that's for them to decide. But it is something that we want to be obviously aware of and on top of.
What I do worry about with the opening of an FCC inquiry is that they may start trying to answer the wrong question, which is to get into the area that Kevin's talking about, which is putting regulators in charge of the internet. And, I mean, the real issue is that causes the problem is we have these old access charge regimes and ways of supporting rural phone networks, which we do need to support, mm-hmm. but they're based on old mechanisms that don't work well in this new internet-based era. And if the FCC chooses to go the route of pounding square pegs and round holes and trying to get the internet enmeshed in that old telephone regulatory regime, I think that would be the worst of all outcomes. It would be much better to somehow overhaul rural phone support so that it gets off the access charge regime. And then you don't have these worries. You don't care how carriers complete their calls as long as they complete them, and you take away this cost incentive for Googles and Skypes and other carriers like that who are providing, frankly, some very good services to people from doing what they may be doing, which is blocking calls.
Because right now, I mean, Tony hit the nail on the head again, that traveling to almost all the telecoms since I've got in office, they rely almost exclusively on the Universal Service Fund to make the services available to their customers to keep up. So if we don't have the right inputs going in, they're not going to be able to make the continued investments that give us the connectivity we need throughout the state. But Tony's point about restructuring the whole thing to get the folks off that, and that would be maybe a good outcome. right now, this is a setup that could take away the input to that universal service fund, which ultimately, in my opinion, would lead to not having the revenue to the investments to keep the technology available throughout our state.
If a rural telecom was having calls to its customers blocked, would the rural telecom know that?
I don't believe so, because in conversation with the congressman's staff, the person making the call got a busy signal, so they didn't even know it was being blocked. So unless somehow they would call on Judy on another phone and figure it out, the person wouldn't even know.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think the person initiating the call is the entity that would have to initiate a concern or a complaint.
And AT&T has weighed in on this too, so there's a lot of factors at play in this, and that's where you can bet that there's numerous different pathways to this taking place right
now. That may be the biggest factor in why this is an issue, is that there's this food fight over net neutrality between AT&T and Google. I'm sure Google's case will be, look, we're an internet voice provider. We're not supplementing the phone network. We don't claim to be, or we're not supplanting the phone network. I mean, so there are other sides to this. People use Skype, for example, and bypass the phone network altogether. And like I said, what I'd hate to see is regulators get too far ahead of the technology and start closing down useful services.
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, the one thing about telephony is that while we have underserved or, challenging rural areas to protect and investments to protect and service to ensure, there is a lot of competition in this world, in the world of telephony. And the last thing we want to do is somehow stifle development and ingenuity. But at the same time, fair is fair. I mean, if you want to be a phone company and you want to route calls into an area, then you ought to play by the same rules as the others have.
Do any of you use the service?
I do not, although I'm intrigued
Google Voice
by it.
I use Skype.
I like the idea of routing all your phone numbers to, being able to aggregate the way Google Voice does, but who knows, maybe soon.
And when you think about the regulatory challenge, Mike Powell, who's former chair of the FCC, made a great observation with Skype, and the same thing would apply to Google Voice, which is if someone files an access charge complaint with the FCC against Skype, where do I send the bill? Skype is literally a server in Eastern Europe.
Yeah.
They can be located anywhere. So it impresses on us how our old telephone rules don't fit the new world.
But clearly, it will probably have more discussion on this, and if they open up their docket, I'm sure we'll weigh in.
Yeah.
But that's why I put it in the schedule, Dale, so we could talk about it.
There's nothing else. We'll recess for a few minutes while we sign orders and come back in
5 minutes.
5 minutes.